Good evening, and welcome to What a World, celebrating diversity and loving it. This is Nevin Campanella, bringing you a radio talk show that has no limits and bows to no one. From this microphone, we bring you guests who will lead you across those shadowy plains of forbidden knowledge. And tonight's radio adventures will be brought to us by Graham Phillips during the first hour and Michael Trudeau during the second hour. Graham will lead us through those shadowy realms of ancient knowledge, and Michael will put us on fast forward into the current world crisis of oil and money. And there certainly seems to be no end to having adventures on this planet, as witnessed by the, again, another tornado, I think it was in Idaho. Charlotte King will give us an update on our next possible adventure with earthquakes. Hi, Charlotte. What do you have for us tonight?
Well, hi, Nevin. It's been a kind of a medium activity week. There's been earthquakes of size to be felt in Taiwan and Peru and the Kuril Islands, Pakistan again. Southern and Northern California have all had smaller events all week. And there's been the consistent stomach pain that goes with the Sierras and the areas of the Wasatch, West Yellowstone, the Big Bear area of California, and sometimes Mount Hood and Mount Rainier in the Cascades in Oregon and Washington. The earaches that I've been getting complaints from people on are mostly the left side earaches. That's China, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan. And those pain, that type of pain is very deep within the ear. There has been some right earaches, and that is mostly the quakes that are going on in Taiwan. People have been complaining of their right legs and knees and ankles hurting, and that's always Peru, Brazil, or Colombia. The right shoulder blade, which has been really tender for the last few days, is the Kuril Islands. And people that have been having the really bad migraines, and especially on the left side of the head and the left eye, that's what you call the Chile connection, or Chile. Chile, Bolivia, Argentina, and the Chile, Bolivia, Argentina border regions. And
let's stop there for a second, Charlotte. Uh-huh. Prior to airtime, you and I were discussing Chile and a recent event in Salem. Uh-huh. Why don't you talk to the audience for a minute or two about that?
Well, Chile has a propensity to be involved in with people's lives when they're on the edge. It kind of pushes them over the top. They might be or may not be manic depressive or bipolar. Many times they are, and they react to this similar to how people react before full and new moons. And for whatever reason, Chile seems to be very, very volatile as far as people's emotions. And we had an event here yesterday morning that started out in a little city north of us called Kaiser. And it started out with a gentleman dousing some kind of flammable liquid on vehicles and trying to burn them, and then shooting at houses in his neighborhood with a gun and other cars, and then going downtown Salem in another vehicle and driving right up the steps into the county courthouse through the glass doors, and then setting fires within the building itself in the courthouse, and finally being subdued and wounded by one of the SWAT team that were on the area and on the scene. And I told people that I talked to right after the event, I said, boy, I said, Chile must be going to have another earthquake. And sure enough, at 4-something this afternoon, I think about 4:18, there was a 5.1 in Chile. And
Charlotte does it again. Charlotte, you're absolutely amazing with that. Go ahead and continue.
Well, it's not to say that this person didn't have some other issues going on, and it's not to say that Chile had to be the factor, but I would say that in 90% of the cases that this type of an event is involved, there's always a quake that follows within 72 hours in Chile. And Chile is also very much involved in when there's suicides create or around Chile events as well. And as I mentioned before, we have a train track that runs through Salem here. We have 3-mile track through the city, and there have been over 30 people in the last 3 years that have died on these tracks, walking, laying down, waiting for the train, walking toward the train, walking away from the train, all of which they could see, and just kept doing it. And these events, every one of them but one, was followed by an earthquake in Chile.
Well, absolutely amazing. Is that a wrap-up now at this point for us tonight?
Only in the respect that there's been a lot of hard stuff, so keep an eye on Mexico. Again, Southern California, El Centro, Mexicali, Calexico. There's been a little bit of symptoms for Washington State. That would be, again, heart, but back ahead pain on the left side. Cats have been throwing up. That's usually an Oregon symptom. Or Japan, if it's over a 6. And we've had a lot of reports of ants coming in. Ants also are part of the quake scenario for most any area. They'll come in, they'll get into everything, and then they will disappear as if they've never been there, and then the quake hits within 12 to 24 hours. The last thing I will mention is the solar activity has been relatively moderate, but a lot of people are experiencing, in fact, I've been experiencing 3 days this week again, the solar flu, which is pressure on the sternum and into the back, which seems to be relieved mostly by taking lethicin and something like a antacid tablet together, and that seems to help. But it mimics a gallbladder attack. And that's all I have for you this week, Nevin.
Thank you so much, Charlotte, for that report, and we will hear from you again next week.
Sounds great.
Also, folks, we do have a toll-free number to take calls. And we if we get some time, we're kind of running late tonight, we will open the phone line. The number is 1-888-268-4313. And again, we'll take them towards the end of the first hour if we get some time. Our guest tonight came on a little bit late. I had failed to get a country code, and so we're all running a little bit behind, but I want to make sure he gets enough time, air time. What happened on this date of November 13th in history? Hey, folks, guess what? 1805, according to some encyclopedias, Johann Georg Ringer invents the hot dog. I'll have more to say to that later on tonight after the second hour is complete. I'm going to try a little investigation of my own, not wanting to compete with our guests, and we're going to call it Nevin's Mysteries. Births, who was born on this date of November 13th? Robert Louis Stevenson in 1850. He's a Scottish writer. I think he died in 1894. I'm not quite sure. But he wrote Treasure Island, Kidnapped, and of course, as everyone knows, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It's kind of amazing that someone that far back in time would be writing such an amazing novel, speaking of personality changes and shifting and then actually having a shape-shifting event take place. Absolutely amazing. Current news? Well, we have stupidity running rampant. Where? Well, first of all, political pundits. And who? Well, this has got to be my most favorite. Bill O'Reilly, he reacted to the San Franciscans' approval of Proposition 1. And what does that do? Well, basically it discourages military recruiters on public high school and college campuses. Now, the most amazing thing about this is that Bill O'Reilly decided that this was un-American. And I'm going to have to actually quote this because I don't want to be called on the carpet later on. He advised, and I'm reading now from an article, he advised President George W. Bush to react by withdrawing any military protection for the city, quote, if Al-Qaeda comes in here and blows you up, we're not going to do anything about it. We're going to say, look, every other place in America is off limits to you except San Francisco. You want to blow up the Quake Tower? Go ahead, O'Reilly said. Folks, can you believe O'Reilly would say something so stupid? Yeah, he can, because he says a lot of stupid things. stupid people say stupid things. What else is in the news? Stupidity running rampant? This, folks, is absolutely unbelievable. The regional planners in California, now these are the people who go around planning the city, the architect, the infrastructure, making sure that everybody in California is as safe as can possibly be given the earthquakes they have. Guess what? Now all of a sudden these people are recommending building an 11-mile tunnel through a mountain range in earthquake country. Logic? There isn't any. This is absolutely dumb. Well, a few hundred years from now, historians will be scratching their heads trying to figure out why anyone would do something so strange, which is, of course, the type of question which motivates Graham Phillips to investigate ancient mysteries. He has been described as a real-life Indiana Jones, but unlike historians seeking answers in dusty old libraries, Graham goes on site and literally digs for answers. Hi, Graham. Welcome to What a World Radio.
Hi there.
How are we doing tonight?
Fine. It's you finally got hold of me in England. It's middle of the night here, quite cold, but other than that, it's peaceful.
Yeah, we have snow here and rain, and I got to tell you, Graham, I'm not used to it. I've been living in the desert for 7 years, and circumstances had me move to northern Utah, so I am now involved with all the cold and snowy, damp weather that you might have there in merry old England. Graham, before we get into the actual interview, why don't you give us a little bit of background about who is Graham Phillips? How did you get involved in being a historical detective?
Well, I started off as a psychologist rather than an historian, and I was interested in the psychology of myth and legend, whether there was any truth behind certain legends, for example, the story of King Arthur, the Holy Grail, stories and legends of Robin Hood. Obviously, they're all things that are based in England. So I investigated them and found, to my surprise, that there was far more historical truth behind some of these stories than most people would give credit, and certainly many historians believed. And it went on from there to the fact that I then started to investigate biblical mysteries, because many historians would say that the stories of the Old Testament concerning the plagues of Egypt, when the skies went dark for days on end, and when the Nile turned to blood and the Red Sea parted to allow the Israelites to escape, stories like that, most historians would say were just myth or legend or religious allegories. But when I began to investigate those mysteries too, I found there was a lot more truth in those than many historians would believe. So, and for the last 20 years, I've written about, I think it's about 12 books on the subject of various historical mysteries. And many of these mysteries involve hidden artifacts. For example, in the Old Testament, we have the Ark of the Covenant, and I already mentioned the Holy Grail. And these are items I've actually tried to search for to find out if there is any truth behind those legends too. So I'm a sort of historian come psychologist come artifact hunter.
Oh, wonderful. You and I have a very similar background. I went from 25 years in clinical practice to becoming a full-time RVer on the road searching for my identity while you're searching for ancient artifacts. Graham, why don't you give the audience your website and how they may be able to get a hold of your books.
Yeah, my website is grahamphillips.net. So that's what my website is, and all my books are listed there. It's very easy to see which books are which, because on my front page I have a picture of each of the covers, and if you click on those you can see what the book's about. And at the end of each little section about each book, I have where you can order them, either from the publishers themselves, which my publisher at the moment happens to be in the US, in Vermont, or you can order them, obviously, from Amazon. And
well, also,
there's links there to order them direct.
Yeah, Graham is listed on What a World Radio, so should you forget his address on the web, go to whataworldradio.com, left menu, look up Graham Phillips, click on his name, and it'll take you right to his website. Graham, I looked at your website, and very impressive, extremely impressive. One of the things that you don't often see with authors is they spend enough time actually putting summaries of each book. And I was able to go through them. It was a rather amazing adventure just going through the website of your material. I was absolutely amazed. I also want to add one other thing. You have a rather stunning portrait of yourself. I mean, I could see the changes in age over time. Very, very stunning looking individual. Well, I want to take these one at a time. I want to start with the Shakespeare conspiracy. And the reason I want to start there is because in my old college days, there were people running around campus in talking about great literature and ideas who were claiming that William Shakespeare didn't actually exist. What did you find out about the Shakespeare conspiracy?
Well, the interesting thing, well, I mean, people might think, well, why am I investigating Shakespeare? Because he wasn't a myth. Well, William Shakespeare may or may not have existed. Some people believe he didn't exist at all. But from the normal historical perspective, Shakespeare was an historical figure. The myth comes into it in regard to the character, the personality that he's supposed to have been. Most people who have studied English literature will hear about sweet Mr. Shakespeare, this wonderful man who never did any harm to anybody, who was a loving husband and father to his children. He went to church regularly and so on and so forth. Well, my suspicions were first aroused by the fact that anybody I've ever known who's been a successful artist, whether they're a writer, a painter, a musician or anything else, has tended to be a rather eccentric or unusual character, really, from the point of view that they have to look at things from an outside perspective in order to gain a new insight into whatever they're doing. They have to be anything other than mainstream. And I thought, no, this doesn't sound right. I mean, whoever Shakespeare was, he was a man who was clearly a genius. He instigated a whole new idea of playwriting and created theatre in the modern sense of the word, pretty much from scratch. So, you know, could he really have been this man that he's portrayed as being? Well, to start off with, when I started to look through the historical records that very few people do, they simply read the books that people have written about him. When you look at the historical records in Stratford-upon-Avon in England, where he was born, you find out that, firstly, there was a number of occasions when he was being sought by the authorities and arrested for drunk and disorderly behavior.
Aha!
That's to start off with.
Yeah, wonderful. Actually, what you're saying, and it makes sense to me, is, would it be possible for a boring person to write such fantastic plays? No. He had to have some fire in him, and you're bringing that out now.
Well, not only was he seemingly a drunk, he also was violent. There are a number of records of him, of people having restraining orders issued against him. Various actors in his theatre company issued restraining orders against him for fear of their lives. There's many things like this that show that, I mean, if asked for being a loving husband, the only thing he left, he died a very wealthy man, and all he left his wife in his will was his second best bed. Well, I don't know what we can read into that, but he left to nothing else. Who he left his best bed to, we don't know, but this isn't the strangest part about him. The weirdest thing is this double life he lived. He lived in Stratford, which is in central England, about 150 miles from London. And in London, which is where he was performing his plays and worked at the Globe Theatre, so obviously he was travelling backwards and forwards. And in Stratford-upon-Avon, on one particular week in the 1590s, he bought the second biggest house in the town for a considerable sum of money. In exactly the same week, he is recorded as being in London, shortly afterwards, running away from a very small rent he owed on an apartment, a seedy apartment in a downtown area of London, which he refused to pay the rent. On another occasion, he is lending vast sums of money to people in Stratford-upon-Avon in central England, while at the same time in London, he's running out on debt, borrowing small amounts of money, and having the courts after him for refusing to pay it back. So you've got, not only is this man seemingly a heavy drinker, he's a bit violent, he's not particularly, you know, great to his wife, he's also leading this really bizarre double life. And when you look in the records in London, you find that he is this playwright, William Shakespeare. He writes all these plays, he performs in them too. But at the same time, in Stratford-upon-Avon, he's recorded as being a dealer in malt and grain. He sells malt and grain to the brewery industry. He's a successful grain merchant. And this is how he's making his money. And you're thinking, well, what's going on here? What's he doing? In fact, people in Stratford didn't seem to know that he even was a playwright. In London, he's the country's best-known playwright. He performs in front of Queen Elizabeth I, the Queen of England, and he's very well-known. But in Stratford, when he dies, the people put a memorial over his grave, and on that memorial there's a statue of him, a bust of Shakespeare showing what he did for a living. And today, that bust shows a man with a feather pen in his hand writing on a parchment, Shakespeare the writer. But that's actually a fake. It was put there in the 1700s to attract tourists. There are old drawings that survive of the original, which show Shakespeare with his hand on a bag, a sack, a malt sack, which shows that when he died, people honoured him as a dealer in bagged commodities, not as a playwright. So he had this weird double life.
Actually amazing. You also mentioned one part that you talked about. You mentioned a conspiracy involving Sir Walter Raleigh and the Elizabethan secret police. Can you tell us a little? Something to do with a plot to kill the Queen. Was Shakespeare involved in that?
Well, he was actually, at the time, the Secret Service was first founded in England. That's the forerunner of now MI5 during the Elizabethan period in the 1500s. And the guy in charge of it, a man called Francis Walsingham, the equivalent of the Prime Minister basically today, he set up this Secret Service in order to spy on Catholics, because at the time England was a Protestant country and the Catholics in this country wanted to try and overthrow Queen Elizabeth. And what happened was that this guy Walsingham set up this Secret Service, which was really an incredible network of spies and informants all over the UK. And he basically wanted people to go around and spy on the lords and the wealthy in England to find out whose side they were on. Were they Catholics or were they Protestants? And some of the people that he employed to do this, believe it or not, were playwrights and actors, the reason being because they travelled widely throughout the country performing their plays in the stately homes of England rather than on stage, because there wasn't many stages in those days. And
are you saying that William Shakespeare was possibly a spy?
The only reason that could account for his strange double life is, in fact, that he was working as a government spy. And there is, it sounds incredible, but I discovered records in London that showed that William Shakespeare was being paid quite a considerable sum of money from the government of England in order for services rendered. And it seems that these services must have had something to do with spying. And in fact, when you look, I said that in Stratford, he's got this, everybody knows him as this grain dealer, this person who is a wealthy merchant. In London, he doesn't earn much money as a playwright, yet he's an extremely wealthy man. Well, his books don't add up, because when you look at the fact that he was earning all this money in Stratford, you find that this molten grain that he was supposedly buying in London and then selling in Stratford didn't exist at all. It was a front. The whole of this grain business was a kind of money laundering operation. He was getting his money from somewhere else. It wasn't through playwriting, because they weren't paid very much in those days. In fact, William Shakespeare working as a spy was the only thing that could account for this money.
Graham, how does someone with that kind of personality write something as intricate as Midsummer Night's Dream? Yeah, give me your personal opinion on that.
Well, I have no idea, but it seems that the thing is that there's very little record of Shakespeare traveling around the world or Europe in order to get the kind of knowledge he got in order to write these kind of plays. And if he was working for the Elizabethan Secret Service, then he would have been traveling all over the place. There wouldn't have been any records of where he went. And this was where he could have got a lot of his information. And if you're working as an actor, he could certainly play the part. And if he's working as a spy, well, that's where he's going to pick up an awful lot of experience.
It almost sounds as if the writing were an accident that happened to be monumental. It absolutely amazes me that a man with that kind of background could write some of the plays that is attributed to him. And let me ask you this. There's a movie, and I don't particularly like it. I was kind of curious about it. It's called Shakespeare in Love. Have you had a chance to see that?
I have, yes, yeah.
And what did you think of the movie?
It was all right. I mean, the Shakespeare that's in it is obviously a little less formal than the Shakespeare we're normally taught about at school. Yet he still comes over as this pretty nice guy and this person who devotes all his time to the theatre. Well, whatever Shakespeare was doing, he wasn't devoting all his time to the theatre. I mean, even from the records in Stratford-upon-Avon, show that he was in London at the theatre only about a third of his time. So, I mean, whatever this guy was, he certainly had a brain that could do a load of things at the same time.
Oh, talk about multitasking. This guy was multi-personality. Graham, let's jump now to Robin Hood, one of my most favorite characters. You've written about him. You call it the man behind the myth. All right. The question I have, was he real? Or just something created by Hollywood?
Well, the man in green tights, the Errol Flynn Hollywood character, is obviously an invention. If there was a Robin Hood, he certainly wouldn't have had a lot of merry men having plenty to eat and drink and having a good time. Life in England during the Middle Ages was very hard for a lot of people. The historians that have looked into the legend of Robin Hood have concentrated on the time of Richard the Lionheart, Richard the First, which is around about in the 1190s, when Richard the Lionheart was away on the Crusades and his brother, the evil King John, was left in charge of the country. That's the time when the story of Robin Hood set in the Hollywood epics and the Kevin Costner film and so forth. But any historian that's looked in that period of time has not found any records of anybody called Robin Hood or anybody remotely like him. So at first, I really, when I looked into the story of Robin Hood, I didn't really expect to find anything else. But I had a look at the earliest story about Robin Hood that still survives intact, which dates from about 1400, called The Little Guest of Robin Hood. Guest basically means, it's an old word for story, so it's a short story of Robin Hood. It's a poem. And it refers to Robin Hood in the forest, and during the story, it refers to the king, but it doesn't refer to him as Richard. It refers to him as Edward, and I thought, this is weird. And then it refers to a tour that the king did throughout England, traveling to various places to collect money off the barons. And there is only one king that is known to have done that exact journey, and that was Edward II. Now, he reigned in the early 1200s, around about 1220, that sort of time. So you're talking about 130 years after the period that Robin Hood's story is set as we know it today. And I thought, well, the very earliest story of Robin Hood that still survives, whether Robin Hood existed or not, is immaterial. The fact is, at that point in time, we're going back 600 years, they thought that Robin Hood lived 130 years later than we now think he lived. And I thought, well, how did we get this idea that he lived during Richard the Lionheart's time? Well, this comes back to Shakespeare, or at least one of Shakespeare's friends, a man called Anthony Munday. And Anthony Munday and Shakespeare, Anthony Munday was a playwright when Shakespeare was just starting off as a playwright, and Shakespeare used to work for him as a kind of secretary. And he and Shakespeare worked on this play that was primarily written by Anthony Munday, so it hasn't gone down as one of Shakespeare's. And it's a full play about Robin Hood, and it's what made the Robin Hood story really popular. And this was written in the 1590s, and it refers to Robin Hood as we know him now, and it sets the story during the time of Richard the Lionheart. Before that, every other reference I found to Robin Hood placed him in this period of Edward II. So clearly, historians, if they were looking for a real Robin Hood, were looking in the wrong period of time. So once I started looking in the 1220s, I discovered that there was a character in the Nottingham area whose name was Robert Hode. That's the spelling at the time. It could have been pronounced Hood. Robin is a nickname, or was at that time, for someone called Robert. So Robin, he's a very similar name, Robert Hode. And this outlaw was, he fought in a rebellion against the king, and he was outlawed in the Sherwood Forest area. And for a number of years, he caused a lot of trouble.
Did he actually do the things that are attributed to Robin Hood, you know, steal from the rich, give to the poor, that kind of thing?
Well, he stole from the rich, but whether he actually got around to giving it to the poor or not, there's no records of that.
It sounds like our politicians.
Well, yeah.
Well, in some of the material on your website, you mentioned that in London, the tale of Robin Hood is actually was around 200 years before Mundy's time. So this particular work, I mean, I think you're correct when you say that this historians have been looking in the wrong era. They really did need to go further back.
Yeah, this is a lot of the problems you get, which actually gives me a lot to write about, is that historians, you know, once they've done their original research and somebody's put together a very scholarly work, then everyone else seems to copy that. So it's not the same if you come to somebody like Napoleon or Abraham Lincoln or people like this. People continue to do new research and research the historical sources, the original manuscripts. But when it comes to figures like Robin Hood, they don't bother because they don't think he exists at all.
Why did historians ignore the actual title? There's a title that you give. It's called A Little, I hope I get the pronunciation right, A Little Guest of Robin Hood.
That's right.
Well, that was around. Why did historians ignore it?
Well, the fact was that, and it's the same with any of these stories, like King Arthur and everything. Historians today, certainly since the Victorian times, if any historian who's attached to a university, so you're talking about professors and so forth, any historian who does anything about Robin Hood, King Arthur, the Bible, anything which is a little bit controversial, tends to get frowned upon, and they don't like controversy of that sort, so they tend to ignore it. So for any historian that does know about that, doesn't write about it. But being a historian, I can do it.
You're suggesting that historians are actually attempting to be politically correct.
They are, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to the Bible, I mean, I know a lot of historians, a lot of my work, I mean, I suppose you could look at me as a kind of historical researcher, stroke psychologist, stroke journalist. So a lot of my work is actually interviewing and speaking to historians and archaeologists. And when it comes to talking about, for example, the Bible, most historians will say, well, there's no evidence for Jesus and any of the things he was supposed to have done. In fact, it goes, what's said in the Bible tends to go against what we know from Roman records and so forth. And I said, well, why don't you write about this then? Oh, no, it would be more than a job's worth if I wrote about that. They'd get kicked out of university posts.
Yeah, they would. You know, I can't think of a more sterile environment than the university And the reason I'm saying that, folks, is because I taught at a university, and I know what it's like. You have to follow the party line. You mentioned King Arthur. Let's jump into that. Was he real?
Again, this is something that historians will say, well, he could have been. The story that we know about King Arthur came about in around about the 1130s when an English bishop, a man called Geoffrey of Monmouth, wrote the story of Robin Hood in pretty much the way we now know it. But he set the story in the 5th century, around about the year 500. Although at that time, what tended to happen when people wrote about historical figures, they tended to set them in their own context. And in other words, in the Middle Ages, when he was writing, knights wore shining armor and they lived in huge Gothic castles. They didn't know, they had no archaeologists then, they hadn't got access to the old Roman records, and they didn't know how people lived. So they just said, well, Arthur must have been a knight in shining armor and he lived in a castle. But in the year 500, or round about then, when the story is being set, it was very different. It was just after the Romans had left Britain. Most soldiers wore Roman-style armor, so they looked more like Romans, and they lived in wooden stockades. Their castles were wooden forts. They weren't these huge, great stone castles that were built in the Middle Ages. So if Arthur existed, he certainly was a very different character. Looked very different, and he lived in a very different world than these stories that have become popular since the Middle Ages. Geoffrey of Monmouth didn't invent King Arthur. He didn't just make him up. He may have told or created the story, and the fighting of dragons and rescuing damsels in distress may have been made up. But a number of earlier writers, one guy in the 830s, a monk, a British monk called Nennius, wrote a history of Britain. It's a pretty straightforward history, where he comes to King Arthur. For all he talks about is this man called Arthur, who led the Britons in a series of successful battles against the Anglo-Saxons, who came from Germany and Denmark and were invading Britain at that time, because most of Britain then were Celts, and they were being invaded by the Anglo-Saxons, who eventually took over the place. And he was fighting them and successfully held them at bay for about a period of 30 years. And this character, Arthur, who was a warrior rather than a king in shining armor, seems to have historically existed because there are these early references to him.
Well, so the battles then, in fact, were real.
Yes, the battles were real. There's a film that came out last year, about King Arthur. Was it last year or earlier this year? About King Arthur, a Hollywood film. I don't think it did very well. They tried to portray Arthur as a Roman-style warrior.
Yes, I saw that film.
That's sort of what he would have been like.
Yeah, it makes sense, especially when you talk about the time period. I mean, you know, the more glitzy type Hollywood portrayals show him with all this fanfare and fancy castles and so on and so forth, and yet in the time period you're talking about, people were living fairly rough, pretty close to the cave.
Well, the Roman Empire had collapsed, and Britain and a lot of Europe had fallen into what we call the Dark Ages, which lasted for hundreds of years, when civilization did collapse, and people were living back in mud huts and things for centuries. And a few of these warriors that still had access to Roman-style weapons were able to basically pretty much rule the country as they wanted. But the interesting thing about Arthur, there are certain legends, stories, which are many people would think were just, well, invention, that seem to be based on historical fact. For example, the story of Excalibur. Most people are familiar with how, when Arthur is dying on the field of battle, his sword is taken and thrown into a lake, and the arm of the Lady of the Lake, a mysterious water nymph, her arm comes out of the water and grabs the weapon and takes it down into the watery depths. Well, that obviously people would say that's just all made up. But interestingly, Roman historians recorded that the Celts of Britain, in other words, the people who were there at the time before the Anglo-Saxons invaded, had a burial custom where a king's sword was thrown into a sacred lake as an offering to a water goddess. And when this sword was thrown into the water, and they believed that the goddess would claim that sword and would therefore offer the king safe passage to the underworld, to the afterlife. So, in other words, it seems that perhaps Arthur may have died and his sword was thrown into a lake to a goddess, or that's the belief, and then as time went by, this story emerged whereby Arthur's sword was thrown to the Lady of the Lake. So in other words, there's a number of the legends of King Arthur which seem to have come about based on religious practices that happened at the time, which makes the whole thing sound more feasible.
Well, there's always a shred of truth to many of the things that we call myths today. One of the very interesting things, to me at least, was when you talked about the name Arthur as not being a personal name, but could in fact be something else. Why don't you mention what you meant by that?
Yeah, well, one of the things is that, I say there was this guy in the 800s wrote about Arthur in early records, but what historians who say, well, he didn't exist at all would argue is that nothing within a couple of hundred years of the time he's supposed to exist mentions him, and other writers at the time don't refer to anyone called Arthur. Which would seemingly be pretty damning evidence that if he's supposed to rule the whole country, he should have been recorded by somebody. But the interesting thing is that warriors of that time, of the Dark Ages, in Celtic Britain, very often adopted what they call battle names. They were given names or titles named after animals, such as the hound, the fox, the horse. And these names were somehow were supposed to typify their prowess in battle, in very much the same way as Native Americans have names after animals. And, well, in the Second World War, you've got Rommel, who is known as the Desert Fox. So you've got a lot of these warriors who are recorded by monks who were writing at that time and by the Romans as having animal names. And I started to wonder whether Arthur could have actually gone down in history under his battle name, named after an animal. Well, interestingly, in Brythonic, that was the language spoken in Britain at the time, which later developed into Welsh, the name Arthur seems to come from the word Arth, A-R-T-H, which in Brythonic means the bear. So Arthur seems to have been his battle name. In other words, he was somebody known as the bear. So when I started to look through the records again of that period, I found that there was a character who did use the battle name The Bear, and his name was Owen Thangwin. That means Owen Whitetooth. And he was a Celtic warrior who came from the centre of England, and the city he ruled from, right in the centre of England, called Viriconium, an old Roman city, has recently been excavated by archaeologists, and they found that it was the most prosperous and well-defended city in Britain at the time Arthur is supposed to have lived. In other words, the character with the name Arth ruled from a place which was seemingly the capital of Britain at the time Arthur is supposed to have lived. So I think this is pretty much proof that Arthur was a real figure, and Arthur wasn't his real name. His real name was Owen Thangwin.
Right, right. It makes sense. It makes sense. What I want to do, we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I really want to get into the legend of the Holy Grail, because there's been so much discussion about it, especially with the more recent events with Dan Brown publishing his book on the Da Vinci Code, so on and so forth. And I also noticed that you have a new edition of this particular book. Why don't you talk a little bit about the Holy Grail? And I'm going to ask you right out. Is it real? Is there really a cup of the Last Supper?
Well, there is. This is where the confusion comes about. There were two early stories about what the Holy Grail was. Grail simply actually means sacred. It comes from the word engrail. So, but the Holy Grail, as we know it, was supposed to be this cup that had miraculous powers. It was used by the disciples to collect a few drops of Jesus' blood after the crucifixion, and thereafter it's supposed to have become endowed with mystical powers. You drank from it and you'd be cured of any ills, or you could live forever. Now, there are two stories of what this cup was, this cup that was used to collect Jesus' blood. The popular story was that it was the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper, brought to Britain eventually by one of his disciples, Joseph of Arimathea. But there was another equally popular story in the early period of Christianity, which said it was a cup used by Mary Magdalene to collect a few drops of Jesus' blood after the crucifixion. And she brought it eventually to Britain. Well, in this country, I decided to follow up the Mary Magdalene lead well before Dan Brown was writing his book, and found that there was people who lived in the centre of England at a place called Whittington, who claimed to have had the cup of Mary Magdalene. It's known as the Chalice of Magdalene or the Marian Chalice. And they claimed to have this cup, and they said it was the Holy Grail. Now, this is recorded in writings that they had, which is preserved in the British Library in England. It just so happened this family was named the Peveril family, and when I looked into their history, I discovered that they were descended from the man who I believe was King Arthur, Owen Sanguine. They were his direct descendants. So the people that were supposed to be descended from King Arthur, somebody who, according to legend, had the Holy Grail, claimed to have it. So I thought, okay, let's see what happened to it. Interestingly, it was passed down from generation to generation until in the mid-1800s, the last line of these people, a man named Thomas Wright, who was a local historian from Shropshire in central England, he decided he had no heir to hand this cup on to, the cup that he thought was the Grail, so he hid it, and he left a intricate series of clues as to where it was. Why he should have done this, goodness only knows, but he did. And the main clue that he left was a stained glass window in a church that he used to attend that he had made and paid to be installed in the church. And it depicts, as well as a number of other things, a figure that's supposed to be St. John holding this chalice. Well, when you look closer, this figure of St. John isn't in fact a man, it's a woman. And it seems to be a depiction of Mary Magdalene. And above this figure's head, there are a number of creatures shown, a bull, a lion, an eagle, and an angel, which were the old Christian symbols for the four Gospels. This, long story short, was a clue that led to four statues depicting a bull, a lion, an eagle, and an angel that were erected by Thomas Wright in some series of underground caves. And in this eagle statue, in the cave, there was in the 1920s some by accident a workman discovered a small cup which was cemented into the base of this statue. It seems that this is what Thomas Wright had done. He'd hidden this cup there. Anyway, I managed to trace the person who found this cup in the 1920s, discovered that his great-great-granddaughter still had it. It was stuffed away in the attic of their house. And when I looked at it, I thought, well, this can't be a cup that goes back to the time of Jesus. I mean, it was a tiny little thing, looked more like an egg cup than anything else. But I took it to the British Museum and just asked them what they thought it was. And they immediately identified it as a first century Roman scent jar that probably originated from Palestine. Now, the first century Palestine is when Jesus and Mary Magdalene were supposed to have lived.
So you actually had this in your hand then?
I had it in my hand, and the thing is that it is made of green alabaster, also known as onyx, and Mary's cup, Mary Magdalene's chalice, the little cup that she had, is described in the Bible as being made of alabaster. So it cannot be proved, but this cup certainly is very old. It's been possessed by this family for centuries. This family are descendants of the man who I think was King Arthur. And if it's a fake, it's a very good one.
Well, what is your personal feeling, Graham?
Well, I don't know. I mean, do I look 52? You've seen my picture. I'm drunk from it. There you go. I found this 10 years ago. Maybe I've stopped aging. No, I jest. But no, it's, I don't know. It's certainly something which somebody, probably going back to the time of the historical King Arthur around about 500, thought it was a holy relic coming from Palestine, and that's what it is. So I don't know.
Well, everyone listening is going to want to know, when you held that in your hands, did you feel anything? I mean, was it, in other words, did anything special occur to Graham Phillips when he held that Onyx Cup?
No, I got excommunicated by the Pope when I first published the story. But as for feeling anything, no, not really. But then again, I'm not very sensitive about that sort of thing. I've had people who've held it who said they feel energy coming from it. I've had people say that somebody had insomnia for years, and after they held it, they didn't have it anymore. Somebody else I know had warts on the hand, and they went within about 2 weeks of them holding it. But, you know, I don't know, nothing to me specifically.
Well, Graham, you're like me. I'm about as psychic as a brick.
Yeah, that's me.
You know, I investigate a lot of these issues by way of reading and talking with people such as yourself, but I fail to get many of the experiences that people report. Unfortunately, Graham, we are out of time. I would like you to spend just a few seconds here wrapping up. What would you like to say to the audience about your research?
Well, the best thing to do, I mean, if they can get on grahamphillips.net and have a look, as you said earlier on, all my books, you don't even have to buy them, actually. You just go on my website and you see everything fully illustrated with lots of pictures. You can see the picture of the cup I found, which may be the Holy Grail, and everything I've been talking about.
Fantastic. Graham, I really appreciate you coming online with us tonight. I apologize for the phone call problem we had. Can we get, we have more to talk about. Can we get you back again at some point?
By all means, thank you very much.
Well, thank you and good night to you.
Good night.
Folks, that's a wrap up for this hour, and we're going to take a, I think a 10 or 12 minute break. I'm assuming that Don is still in the background. Okay, folks, break time. I am off the air for probably 12 minutes or so. We are going to run some music and I think a commercial that I made a few weeks ago. Listen in. It's not really a tough commercial. Easy to listen to, and I think I even have a story on there. I'll be back on the air in 12 minutes.
Tired of the same old plastic trophy award? For a unique awards or gift, call Eagle Awards in Montgomery, Alabama at 334-271-2277 between the hours of 8 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Their laser-engraved awards and gifts are unique, creative, and unmatched in workmanship. Talk to Steve for suggestions on getting a laser-engraved photo or browse the store's catalog at www.eagle-award.com. That's www.eagle-award.com. And how about a reward for your body? For millennia, savvy Chinese women maintain beautiful, young-looking skin well into advanced age. How do they do it? Their secret was a blend of exotic herbs now offered by Lamaze Beauty Products. Try the Lamaze Chinese Herb Body Lotion for smooth, firm, and youthful skin. You can view their product line at www.lamazebeauty.com. That's www.lamazebeauty.com. Or use their toll-free number, 877-604-6521. Their business hours are 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., Monday through Friday, Pacific Time. Now, on the more serious side of life, did you know that each year, 182,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer, and 43,300 die? Almost everyone knows someone whose life has been affected by a breast cancer diagnosis. Breast cancer is the leading cause of cancer deaths among women ages 40 to 55. Early detection is the key to survival, and mammography is among the best-known methods of early detection. Yet, 13 million women in the United States over 40 have never had a mammogram. With the simple daily click of a pink button at the breast cancer site, that's www.thebreastcancersite.com, Visitors help provide mammograms to those in need. Visitors pay nothing, and funding is paid by site sponsors and benefits the nonprofit National Breast Cancer Foundation. While early detection is highly sophisticated for such problems as breast cancer, it is still in the infancy stage for those catastrophic events which affect large populations. Lately, it seems like there is a crisis on this planet of mega proportions on a weekly basis. A few weeks ago, it was Hurricane Katrina in the United States, and now it is the horrendous earthquake in Pakistan, which has devastated the population. So far, there are 40,000 dead and up to 4 million affected. Please spend a moment of your time at www.concern.net. That's www.concern.net, and learn how to get involved with those in need. The news leaves one with the impression that maybe our world is a bit screwed up. For myself, I believe that what we see and experience is part of the wondrous experiment of third dimension reality, and is part of a total divine plan of existence. In attempting to convey this idea, I wrote the following vignette regarding our seemingly imperfect planet. It is titled, The Perfectly Imperfect Cup of Tea. And of course, the actors on the stage, myself and my lovely wife Jill. Nevin and Jill had just sat down for a cup of tea at the Two Moon Tea House in the Enchanted Forest. He was feeling a bit cavalier and decided to order something different. How about trying something different? Asked Nevin. With a quizzical look on her face, Jill said, Okay, but you know you're not real big on change. That's not entirely true, answered Nevin. I just don't like unexpected changes. Looking over the menu, Nevin spots a tea with an unusual name. Hey, look at this, he exclaims while pointing at the menu. Now what the hell could that mean? I have no idea, answered Jill. That is really weird. Now why would anyone name a tea the Perfectly Imperfect Cup of Tea? Who cares? Let's order it, answered Nevin. Not wanting to seem stodgy, Jill agreed. The waiter was quite pleasant and within minutes brought two steaming, perfectly imperfect cups of tea to their table. At first they were a little hesitant, as one might expect, but soon they were sipping tea and deeply engaged in pleasant conversation about their last vacation. Just as Jill was about to ask Nevin where he might like to take their next vacation, she noticed a rather sour look on his face. Something wrong? She asked. Well, yes, now that you mention it, this tea's a bit bitter. Then reaching for a packet of sugar, he said, Maybe this'll help. Jill seemed content with her tea and watched as Nevin began pouring the sugar into his cup. After a few tentative sips, he said, Damn, the tea is still bitter. Something is wrong with this tea. After adding numerous packs of sugar with no change in the bitter taste, he then stood up and waved at the waiter in an attempt to get his attention. Seeing Nevin's distress, the waiter quickly went over to their table and politely asked, Is there a problem? Hell yes, there's a problem, shouted Nevin. There's something wrong with this tea. Looking at his cup, the waiter said, Well, it looks okay. What's wrong with it? It's bitter. And no matter how much sugar I put into it, the damn thing still tastes bitter. In fact, it seems the more sugar I put into it, the worse it gets. Of course it's bitter, said the waiter. That is what you ordered. With an indignant look, Nevin said, It most certainly is not what I ordered. I ordered a perfectly imperfect cup of tea, not bitter tea. But, answered the waiter, that is why it's called perfectly imperfect. It will never suit your taste. Not quite satisfied with the answer, Nevin asked, But I added sugar, and the damn thing is still bitter. Obviously, something is wrong with the tea. Of course it's bitter, replied the waiter. If you wanted a perfect cup of tea, then that is what you should have ordered. Nevin was getting frustrated with the conversation and asked, What the hell difference does it make? If I put sugar into something, it should get sweet. With a sigh of exhaustion, the waiter said, Sir, no matter how much sugar you put into it, it will never quite suit your taste. It is the cup you ordered that keeps it imperfect, and the more you attend to the tea, the greater the imperfection. And you did order the perfectly imperfect cup of tea. If you wanted imperfect tea in a perfect cup, you should have said so. This little view of life over ordering a cup of tea is my explanation of why things are the way they are. It may not satisfy the internal quest for the reason for existence, but it does address a small essential component of our thinking. Sometimes we get the idea that somehow our world is out of balance. There is nothing out of balance, and everything is in fact perfectly imperfect, because that is why we are here in this particular dimension, to be entertained and, if possible, learn from the imperfection. If you want something different, then you must change cups. Attention to the original order will only produce more of the same. As an example, a dimension, or the cup if you will, designed to produce controlling, non-caring world leaders will not change in design because you vote for different leaders or engage in demonstrations against those in power. The cup is designed so that regardless of what you do, you will get what you ordered, and that is an existence of controlling, non-caring world leaders. In other words, you must change your order, or your intent. Now, the really tricky part of this is to recognize that it is your intent that is, in fact, the cup.
Good evening, and welcome back to What a World. During the first hour, we investigated ancient knowledge, and now we're going to fast forward to the 21st century, where wars and corporate intrigue just dominate the headlines almost on a daily basis. Tonight, Michael Trudeau, an investigative journalist for over 15 years, will give us some insight as to why we're paying through the nose for gasoline. Hi, Michael. Welcome to What a World.
Well, how you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, Michael, I've been wanting to ask a lot of questions about gasoline prices, and I think you're the man to tell us. But before we get into that, Michael, on What a World Radio, why don't you tell the people who you are and how did you come about to be a investigative journalist?
Well, you know, how I came about the, path that I'm on as far as investigative journalism is because I began working quite by accident for an old newsman from CBS by the name of Charles Corrault. And through my travels and working with Mr. Corrault, he gently prodded me down this pathway into journalism. And again, it's more of a freelance aspect. I've done a lot of other things too. One of the other things I am heavily involved in is economics. And so I've got a knack for being able to pin the two together. So generally speaking, what I go after as far as my own interests always revolve around money and how it's going to affect us.
Michael, I know you have a lot of material out there. How would a person go about getting copies of your books and what you have written? I know you don't have a website, or do you?
Sure. Well, I've actually got a couple of different websites. There's a lot of information available and a lot of articles that are available up on my main website, which is a precious metals company that I co-own with my longtime friend John Pisciano. And of course, anybody who wants to get some of the articles that I'll be talking about tonight can feel free to get those right off of that website, which is simply www.colonialresources.com. And then also, if folks want to have a pen and a piece of paper ready, I can give out information that folks who may not have access to computers, I can send out to them in the mail. So if they want more information on the peak oil crisis, which we'll be discussing tonight, we can talk about that. So you might just want to have a pen ready.
Oh, absolutely. The problems going on within our civilization with money and oil are just mind-boggling. Now, to get started, right off the bat, somewhere, I don't quite remember where I read it, but I know it comes from you, because I have it in quotes. It says, civilization, as we know it, is coming to an end soon. Okay, Michael, why don't you explain that?
Yeah, and that's a good point to stop on right there, because, again, civilization as we know it, and that's the key here, is as we know it is coming to an end soon. I would never make the claim that civilization is coming to an end yet. The problem with making that claim, as many people have done over the millennia, is, of course, if you give a date as to when the end of the world is and you're wrong, well, you lose credibility the day after. So no,
yeah, they're running out of town on a rail.
Yeah, right. This is generally this is a generalization when we talk about civilization as we know it. And the reason is because what's happening is, literally speaking, we are going to be heading into the era of the end of cheap oil. And the problem with that, of course, is that every economy globally has been built up upon the abundant cheap oil that has been accessible to us over the years. And now, of course, the issue is that we're running out of that abundant cheap oil. It's getting more expensive to pull out of the ground, and the oil that's coming out is lesser quality. And that's something that was predicted many years ago. And again, this is something that, is not some whacked out conspiracy theory. This is based on a lot of scientific research. A lot of the best paid, most widely respected geologists, physicists, investment bankers in the world have come to this conclusion. These are very, very, very rational, professional, conservative individuals who are absolutely terrified by a phenomenon that we now know as peak oil. This was originally pointed out back in the 50s by a Shell geologist by the name of Dr. Marion King Huber. As a matter of fact, in 1956, he accurately predicted that U.S. domestic oil production would peak in 1970. He also predicted that global production would peak in 1995, which it would have had the politically created oil shocks of the 1970s not delayed the peak for about 10 to 15 years. Thus, it's hitting now instead of a decade ago. Again, when we talk about are we running out of oil, the answer to that in the short, term is no. Basically, what we're talking about, again, is a bell curve, because all production of oil follows a bell curve. It's true whether we're talking about an individual field, country's oil, or the planet as a whole. Oil is increasingly plentiful on the upslope of the bell curve, increasingly scarce and expensive on the downslope. The peak of the curve coincides with the point at which the endowment of oil has been 50% depleted. Once the peak is passed, oil production begins to go down while the cost to get it begins to go up. In practical and considerably oversimplified terms, this means that if 2000 was the year of global peak oil, worldwide oil production in the year 2020 will be the same as it was in 1980. However, the world's population, of course, will be much larger than it was in 1980. And, of course, the other aspect is that much more industrialized and oil-dependent than it was in 1980. The last part of that is one of the things we look at, of course, is that China and India are now becoming, heavily industrialized nations. They're very large populations, and these guys are absolutely gobbling up the world's oil as we speak.
Well, you mentioned in one of your articles that we're going to have to come up and we're going to have to add 50 million barrels a day by the year 2010. Where do you get 50 million barrels?
Well, see, that's just a problem you don't. And again, this is where we have this issue. That estimate, by the way, of where that came from was from Dick Cheney. When he was the CEO of Halliburton, he made a speech in 1999 where he talked about this issue of peak oil. And he said, and this is a direct quote of his, by some estimates, there will be an average
of 2% annual growth in global oil demand over the years ahead, along with conservatively a 3% natural decline in production from existing reserves, which means that by the year 2010, we will need on the order of an additional 50 million barrels a day. And again, when we take a look at Cheney's assessment, it's supported by the estimates of numerous non-political, retired, now disinterested scientists, many of whom believe global oil production will peak and go into terminal decline within the next 5 years. Some geologists expect 2005 to be the last year of the cheap oil bonanza, while estimates coming out of the oil industry indicate a seemingly unbridgeable supply-demand gap opening up after 2007, which will lead to major fuel shortages and increasingly severe blackouts beginning around 2008 through the year 2012, somewhere in that area.
You know, okay, so, what?
Go ahead.
How do you equate this to the recent congressional hearings with the CEOs of these major oil corporations that are receiving millions of dollars, and the Congress is saying to them, hey, folks, we were supposed to have a crisis. If there was a crisis, how come you're getting all the money and our citizens are getting skinned?
Yeah. Well, first off, you know, small surprise there, I guess, when we see that the oil executives are glomming, you know, above average profits during a crisis. You know, part of the thing, of course, is that if there's a crisis and there's an emergency and you see the prices of oil rising rapidly based on the speculation as to what a hurricane might or might not be doing in the future here or how long it might take us to put the oil back online, and they take advantage of that, illegally take advantage of that, then I think certainly we've got every right to go after them. I think when we look at Congress, so to speak, going after these guys, what you're seeing is, you know, all for show. I don't think that it's, you know, in actuality, I don't think that Congress would truthfully go after the oil companies. I mean, after all, most of the congressmen that are there drilling these guys also own major stakes in these companies. So, you know, it's kind of a conflict of interest when you have somebody like the Bush family or Cheney family who are, you know, major players in oil companies who are, you know, obviously the ones who are drilling these oil execs. Again, it, you know, it's, I think it's more for show than anything else.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Michael, I'm convinced, and if there's anybody out there that's not convinced, then they're just not listening to what's going on, that our politicians are about as crooked as you can get. And I don't have any problem with saying that on the air. There is no such thing that I know of as ethics in terms of politics. Well, when we get to this apocalyptic meltdown of epic proportions that you're talking about, you also make a comment about the coming cashless society. What is that?
Coming cashless society is something we're seeing all around us. There's no question about that. That is, I'll give you a perfect example when I say we're seeing it all around us. The best way for me to describe it is that they are slowly removing cash out of the system, and they're making people become dependent on what we would call a smart card or an RFID microchip card that carries our banking data for us. So instead of using actual physical paper currency, we simply pull out with the smart card or the RFID card, bang it in front of a scanner to pay for our items, no PIN number required, we walk away at the touch of that amount right out of our accounts, and again, without any cash ever touching hands. Couple of examples of that. Number one, right off the bat, this is a real recent article that I've got, just came out on the end of October there, and this is something that's happening right now in New York City that they're doing. They've been testing the smart cards, you know, worldwide now for many years, and now what's happening is we're seeing the actual implementation. And I'll discuss a little bit as to why this is happening after I give you the aspect of, to show you that it is. And this is J.P. Morgan Chase & Company saying that they have begun rolling out their contactless credit cards known as Blink in New York and Philadelphia metropolitan areas. Chase is delivering the cards, which use a radio frequency ID chip or RFID chip, to 2 million customers, roughly about one-fourth of the population of New York City, and 900,000 customers in the Philadelphia area. Merchants that are currently accepting them are, you know, 7-Elevens and AMC Theaters, CVS Pharmacies, Duane Reade, Regal Entertainment, Sony Style Stores, but basically they're eventually to be used anywhere that Visa and MasterCard will be accepted, which will be everywhere at one point. Problems that are developed right off the bat with a couple of these things that you might, you know, want to think of is, considering the fact that there's no PIN number required here and that there's no signature required here, first question that comes to my mind is, what happens if I lose mine or somebody steals it? The other thing that immediately comes to mind is that the growth of these credit card databases and these debit card databases recording our every movement worries a lot of people, as does the ability of the banks to take a cut of all of the electronic transactions in ways that they never could with cash. And that's certainly a significant aspect as to the why they're doing it. Right now, you and I can provide, conduct a private transaction between the two of us that uses just cash. And nobody's the wiser as to what the transaction might have been. I might swap you out a $10 bill for the coffee cup in front of the microphone there. And you might agree to that transaction. We, as citizens of this country, as provided by the U.S. Constitution, have formed a contract between the two parties. And this was a private transaction. You take cash out of that system, which never should have been there to begin with. We're supposed to be using gold and silver, but that's another complete story. But if you take that system away, cash out of the system, then at that point, every single transaction will be trackable. And the reason for it is very simple. This goes back to 1913 when the Federal Reserve Act was born and the Federal Reserve came into being. And the first misconception, of course, that most people have is that the Federal Reserve Bank is a branch of the United States government, when in fact it's not. The Federal Reserve Bank is a private company. Most people believe it's as American as the Constitution, but the fact is the Constitution actually forbids its existence. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution states that Congress shall have the power to create money and regulate the value thereof. Problem is we've given that illegally now to a batch of private bankers. And when we talk about this batch of private bankers, I'll give you the numbers. There's roughly 300 stockholders in this privately held company, the banking cartel, the central banking cartel and Federal Reserve System. This is the only for-profit corporation in America that is both tax-exempt at the federal and state levels. These guys collect, these 300 privately held private bankers, if you will, the stockholders, collect somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1 trillion tax-free annually and split it between the 300 of them. And, you know, you start to wonder, well, where's this $1 trillion come from? Well, basically where this $1 trillion is coming from is these guys are skimming it right out of our wallets. And the way they're doing
it. So Greenspan retired very wealthy is what you're saying.
Well, Greenspan retired very wealthy. There's no question about it. But if you go back to Greenspan, arguably one of the nation's better economists going back in time. And in the 60s, here's one of the guys that came forth and said that deficit spending is a hidden scheme for the theft of your wealth. And that the only thing that stands in the way of that insidious process is the ownership of gold. And that's because, of course, gold is something that can't be manipulated like the currency can. The Federal Reserve, of course, can print currency at will. And as they do that, then, of course, they can inflate or deflate at will and, of course, and control the economy. Thereby, controlling the economy, creating boom and bust periods is a wonderful thing because for them, anyways, because as they create a boom period, we all get comfortable and fat and start adding on the credit. And the second we get stacked up to the eyeballs, and I mean we're loaded with credit right now, of course, right as we're looking at it, probably the largest credit tab ever, and they start to pull the wool out. And as soon as they do that, people begin to have to, as the economy contracts, they start losing their jobs, they have to foreclose on their houses and so on. And as that happens, basically what happens is the Federal Reserve System steps in and says, well, look, thanks for the house, get out, best of luck to you on the next go around, we're going to sell it now to the next guy in line. And generally speaking, what's happened here is since 1913, we have unwittingly given this group of bankers, this group of families, all of our property, all of our possessions, and now we give them our labor. And what I mean is, most people in America don't really own their own home. Oh, sure, I've got my own house, and I'm sure most of the listeners do as well. But in reality, I've got a big fat mortgage that I'm paying off. In addition
some people are paying on interest only.
Another argument altogether. And you know, you get onto these floating arm mortgages, and as they begin to raise these interest levels right now, the interest rates, you can see how this is pushing people right out of their homes as we speak. But again, I don't own my house. I don't own my car. I pay on that. And every time I get a paycheck, I take that money. I give it right to the bank as I pay off these debts. So again, they own my house, they own my car, and they own my labor.
Okay,
Thomas
Michael,
Jefferson warned us back a couple hundred years ago when he said, if the American citizens ever allow private banks to issue their currency, then first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that grow up around them will deprive the people of their property until they wake up homeless, on the continent their fathers conquered.
Okay. I understand the issue. But I have a question for you, Michael. I've heard a lot of arguments, from people who say, look, we should have a gold standard, so on and so forth. We are headed into this cashless society. But the question I have is, how would we be able to operate at the speed with which we do if we were still operating on paper money, or even paper money that had a gold backing? I can't imagine trying to do some of the things that I do today as quickly as I do. For instance, getting on the net, ordering something, and the next day it's on my doorstep. That all occurs because of a credit card. Is it possible to expand society at that kind of rate and still use a guaranteed paper-backed gold-type money?
Well, in fact, it would be, because, again, it wouldn't matter if it was a physical paper or not. But what we've got right now is just simply valueless paper. So the same thing will happen when we're talking about a plastic credit card or a plastic debit card or a microchip, because there is no gold backing any of our currency. The only thing that gives our currency any value, and it only gives value to the debtor nations, the other countries that are holding our debt right now, and that is the fact that our government can force the citizenry to pay taxes. Now, if the government loses that grip on forcing the citizens to pay taxes, then the game's over as far as the other nations being able to look at this value. But the other thing, of course, is that the cash has been losing its value for our entire lifetimes, and that's because it's backed by nothing. These guys have been taking the value away from the cash slowly but surely over our lifetimes. And again, it's very simple to see this, because when you talked about that gold standard and whether or not the benefit would be there, it's very simple to see it. And I've got a great example. In 1967, my folks bought their first house. They paid $16,000 cash for it. And today that house is $200,000. Well, they paid $16,000 cash, or the equivalent of 472 ounces of gold. Today, if I wanted to buy that same house, I would have to come up with $200,000, not $16,000, or 472 ounces of gold. So again, the bottom line to this is that this felonious, I don't know what else to call it, because of, it goes beyond description what has happened to this nation from the Federal Reserve, or by the perpetrator, by the Federal Reserve. And to give you some examples of people who might agree with me, Henry Ford said, "It is well that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system, for if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." Another interesting quote that came out a while back, 1932 to be exact, is, "We have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board. This evil institution has impoverished the people of the United States and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the corrupt practices of the money vultures who control it." So again, you know, this is an evil group. They've been around for quite a while, and they've been pretty effective at stripping this nation of its wealth, just like Thomas Jefferson warned us would happen if we gave them the power to do it.
Why? Why would the feds deliberately cause economic booms and busts? I mean, what's
again,
the
very
point?
Simple. No, that's very simple as far as the reason, the rationale for that. Imagine if we could do that, if we had the power to control this. If I create a boom period, the very next thing that happens is people start getting comfortable. Boy, in a boom period, of course, everybody has a great job. And there's no worries ahead because consumer confidence is cruising at its greatest levels. And when you're in that position, you're thinking, hey, life is good. And there's no reason for me to fear anything in the future because life is so good and my job is so great and my wife's job is so great and we got money rolling in from everywhere. And you know what? I work hard. I deserve a little bit better house and I deserve a little bit nicer car and maybe even a big screen TV to watch Monday Night Football on. So I go out there during this period when I'm feeling so confident and I start to stack on the debt, and that's exactly what they know you'll do. The second they get to the point where everybody is up to their eyeballs in credit, as I pointed out, that's when they began to create the bust period. And at that point, you see the economy fall apart. The recession begins. People lose their jobs. And as soon as that happens, as they raise those interest rates, what's happening? They're forcing people out of their mortgages. When you get to those interest-only loans, and that's great that I can get that interest-only loan, and what's my monthly payment, and then the interest rate goes up, and the interest rate goes up, and the interest rate goes up like they're doing now. And again, you're forced out of those possessions, And those possessions go right back to who? Right back to the bank that you took the loan out to get them. They simply turn around then and loan it out to the next guy. You get back
so this
to
is,
the beginning of the line and start over.
This is all about certain people making money. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what this is about. This is about
how much money is enough? I mean, we're talking about some extremely wealthy people.
You're right about that. When you asked a perfect question about how much is enough, and I want to touch on that real quick and about how wealthy these guys are. I had a caller on a previous radio program I was doing call up and say, you know, how rich are these guys? I mean, I thought the richest guy in the world was Bill Gates. And I commented, yeah, Gates is a pretty rich character. He's got somewhere in the neighborhood, depending on who you listen to and when, about 55, maybe $65 billion. You could take his money and you could put it into a thimble, and then you could set that thimble down into the middle of the Astrodome and fill up the rest of the space in that Astrodome with what Jay Rockefeller owns. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about that kind of money. When we talk about $55 billion, I mean, isn't that enough? If it was, Bill Gates would have retired a happy customer, but no, he's still working 9 to 5.
I don't understand.
Bankers, you know, how much is enough? All of it.
Yeah, I guess the problem I have is it's hard to understand the motivation of someone who has, you know, numbers that we can't really describe. And believe me, the listening audience, most of our listening audience is operating close to the belt. Trying to understand why someone with so much wealth and power would want more. I mean, it doesn't make any sense in my head.
Well, have you heard the adage before that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely? Well, this is a group of people that have absolute power. It was signed into law by Woodrow Wilson in 1913, pushed through Congress by Nelson Aldrich while Congress was on congressional vacation for Christmas. And as he pushed that through and had that bill passed, Woodrow Wilson signed it as he promised he would do to these fat bankers. We should mention that Nelson Aldrich is the maternal grandparent of the Rockefellers, grandfather of the Rockefellers. And I will give you a quote from President Woodrow Wilson after that had occurred. He gave two wonderful quotes. The first one was, "I have unwittingly signed away my nation." And he's talking about when he signed the Federal Reserve Act into law. And the second one is, "A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the world. No longer a government of free opinion, no longer a government of conviction and vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of small groups of dominant men." And that was a quote directly from President Woodrow Wilson, who signed that group of men, so to speak, into law.
So the government is looking to abolish cash. Okay. Why and how will they go about it? How will they get us there?
Well, the how will they get us there is a really simple process. They've already basically pretty much pulled it off. The first thing they'll do is conditioning us into believing that there's a problem with cash, which, of course, you and I see that every day. How do we see that? A couple of different ways. In the last decade, they've been changing the currency, and you might have noticed it. The first batch that came around, that's one of the things that got me going on this, incidentally, was when they first started doing these currency changes. And, of course, I'm a monetary specialist. I've been a numismatist and a coin collector pretty much my whole lifetime. So anything that has to do with money or changes in money, I follow along with. And they talked about the fact that there's this problem with counterfeiting. So we're going to be changing the currency. We'll start with the hundreds, the 50s, and the 20s, and we'll, you know, create a larger portrait, and we're going to put some microfern around that portrait. We'll put a metal strip in the bill, some watercolor features, and so on. And then we're going to move down to the next phase with the 10s, the 5s, and the 1s. And that, again, is the first time that really tipped me off to this issue, was when I heard the 10s, the 5s, and the 1s. And the first thing that dawned on me was, who would counterfeit $1 bills? I mean, you'd have to counterfeit a garage full of them to do you any good. And then what, you're carrying suitcases of $1 bills around with you to buy a sofa? So that didn't make much sense to me. It made me start to look a little deeper at this problem of counterfeiting, and it began with the 1980 Drug Smuggling Act, the Omnibus Drug Smuggling Act, where they talked about money laundering, and we've got to have the Know Your Customer rule so that bankers will pay attention to customers and their private banking practices and so on. And it progressed from there as they went into the currency changes to move on to the fact they said, well, darn, this isn't working, so we're going to do it again. And now they've got the pretty colored bills that are coming out. So you'll notice some of those. As a matter of fact, they just announced with big fanfare the release of the new $10 bill that'll be showing up now. But we've already seen the 50s and the 20s, the colored ones with the nice pink and blue views and the yellows to them. And, of course, the problem is, again, the nefarious counterfeiter. And, again, I point to the conditioning aspect because if you go to a store today, a convenience store, if you go to a liquor store, what have you, and you spend a $50 or $100 bill or a $20 bill, a lot of the times, first thing that happens is a magic marker will come out, and they'll make a mark on your bill to make sure it's not a counterfeit. So one of the things that's also dawned on me, of course, as I've been watching this battle against the nefarious counterfeiters is, boy, in all this effort that the Secret Service has been pulling off and the Treasury Service to stop these evil counterfeiters, where are they? How come we're not hearing of any counterfeiting rings getting broken up in this last 15-year push since they began changing the currencies? And basically, if you want to go all the way back to the 1980 period, it's been roughly 25 years. I'm not seeing too many counterfeiting rings being broken up by Know Your Customer or this money exchange. So I started asking at the clerk station, you know, the place where they'd actually be seeing these things. I'd see the convenience store, and the clerk would be sitting right there at the cash register. I'd throw a $20 bill down and a $50 bill, what have you. They'd make the check mark, and I'd start, you know, with, hey, what are you doing there? And they'd come back with, oh, we're checking that for a counterfeit. Oh, really? Is that you get any of those yet? No? I've asked now over 100 clerks if they've ever seen a counterfeit bill. Not one yet has told me they have. In addition to which, the only counterfeiting ring I've ever heard being broken up on CNN or Fox News so far is maybe a college kid or a high school kid who got caught making a bogus 20 on the school printer to buy beer with or a concert ticket. So
yeah, there's not much on the news in terms of that kind of thing.
No, again, this was such a rampant problem, and they've come up with all these great ways to bust these counterfeiting rings. You would be hearing about these on the daily news. So again, they're showing you that there's a problem with cash, with this counterfeiting, and there really isn't a problem is what I'm pointing out, or at least I don't believe there's a real problem. I think, again, this is more of the conditioning. How they'll pull
there's
it out?
Go ahead. There's a rumor about $100 bills being different in Europe and Russia, American currency, than they are here. Is that true?
Well, there's a couple different aspects on that, and you're right, it is a rumor, and nobody's going to tell us whether or not it's truthfully there. I think that if it was accurate, we'd be seeing these red bills by now, by accident floating through. Some Russian traveler might accidentally spend one at the store, and somebody would be going, hey, what's this? I've never seen a red $100 bill before. So again, you know, I think it's more rumor than anything else. I've not seen one myself yet, and until I do, I'll hold back on that one.
Does the government actually track money now? I mean,
yeah,
is there any way to do it?
Absolutely not a question about it. As a matter of fact, when we look at, you mentioned the European currencies and so on, the euro dollar, the euro currency, has got an RFID microchip in it. The Europeans have at least had, I guess, I don't know if you'd call it the decency or the audacity, I think it's probably the latter of the two, to come right out publicly and say, yeah, we put microchips in our currency. Well, the Americans are doing the same thing. The difference between the two countries is we're not coming out and publicly stating it. It's just that it is happening. There might
be. Are you saying there is a microchip in our money?
Absolutely.
Is that detectable by the naked eye, or what would a person
have? No, it wouldn't be detectable by the naked eye because it's too small. We're talking about something that's embedded in the bill itself, and it's probably, you know, much smaller diameter than a grain of sand. One of the things we have to remember with a microchip at this point in the technology of things is when we hear about something today, we have to assume that we're hearing old news, no matter how up to speed we are. Give you an example of that, the SR-71 Blackbird, the stealth technology, of course, we hear about this thing for the first time on the news, and we see this beautiful black plane and so on. Well, of course, the thing had been flying for over a decade. So again, the same thing is here. What I can talk about now is, of course, we have conductive ink technology. And, you know, we're talking about being able to create a microchip out of conductive ink today. So the question is, where are we truthfully, technologically speaking? I think we're probably progressed further on than that. The chip inside the bill could certainly be as innocuous as conductive ink.
Will there be a point where some retailers will not accept cash, that they're going to go strictly cashless?
Absolutely, no question about it. And it won't be when a selected group of retailers will. It will be when they announce that they're taking cash out of the system altogether, and it will happen overnight when that occurs. Again, they're not going to warn you. They're not going to want you to be able to get your ducks in a row before they pull it off. What they will simply do is they will simply close the banks on a Friday, probably maybe even on a three-day a holiday, and they'll close the banks at regular business time on a Friday, and then they will declare a bank holiday. The Emergency Banking Act is still open and active So they need do nothing. They don't need to go to Congress and ask Congress permission or anything else. They simply declare bank holiday, and the banks are locked down and closed on a Friday. Come Monday or Tuesday, we've all got our brand new Blink cards from Chase Manhattan, if you will, or whatever bank is going to be passing them out. And they'll come in the mail, or we'll, you know, be able to pick them up right at the post office, most likely. And at that point, what they'll tell us is all of the money that we had in the bank, or all of the money that we had in our Ginnie Mae's or our 401k's or what have you, has all now been converted to our account with our microchip card, our debit card, that will now be used as cash in the place of cash.
What about the money in my pocket?
In your pocket, you bet. What they'll do at that point is give you a 30-day window to bring that in, and that will then be applied to your account. After 30 days, that cash might as well be used as, well, maybe if you wash it a few times, it might soften up and you might find another use for it.
You mentioned smart cards. Is there any way that someone can tamper with a smart card? Forge one?
Well, again, when we talk in the beginning about this new card they're sending out into New York City, you got to scratch your head on this one because, again, they're sending this out now already to one-fourth of the entire population of the largest city in the world. Well, I shouldn't say in the world, but in America. And these things require no PIN, no personal identification number, no signature, or nothing else. You simply wave it in front of the scanner, and you walk away with your Big Mac. So if on your way out of McDonald's you drop the card instead of putting it in your pocket and Bob walks by and picks it up, what's to stop him from walking in and waving it in front of the counter and getting his Big Mac?
Oh, and you could do that now with the credit card that I now have in my pocket. I go into Walmart, I get my stuff, I go through, I swipe it through the thing, and then I'm asked to sign. Well, no one has ever asked to look at the back of the card to see if the signature that I'm signing is the same. And on top of that, many of the signatures now aren't even on paper.
Right.
You sign on a screen.
So, my debit card from the bank, which is my account from my own checking account, I can go up to the gas pump and you simply are required to stick it in and pull it back out. There's nothing signed. There's nothing done. And I drive away with a tank full of gas. So you're right. There's already ways that you can use those. Fairly nefariously, if you'd like to, I suppose. No question about it.
Oh, it would be simple if you could get a hold of a card. And then, I was just listening to some advertisements on, Visa. I think it was Visa and MasterCard both. And, you know, they're really pushing this concept that if your card gets stolen, you don't owe anybody anything. I don't understand.
Where's the money?
The total ramifications,
yeah.
But it kind of makes you people uncautious. In other words, if you don't have any responsibility, then aren't you going to be less cautious with that card?
Right. You also asked about places, where retailers will just be accepting, these cards now instead of cash. And one of the things that a lot of people certainly are seeing after being pointed to is that you can go to various stores across the country now and see these contactless pay systems being implemented. I mentioned CVS Pharmacy was one of the ones that the Blink card will be accepted at. Well, look, CVS Pharmacy made the announcement last year that by the end of 2005, they would have contactless pay systems in place at all 5,300 stores across 38 states. So these guys are pretty serious. Albertsons, and they're the number one, by the way, that CVS Pharmacy is the number one retail pharmacy in the country. Albertsons just made the announcement. They're the number two retail grocer in the country that they're doing the same thing. Go to Walmart. They're at every Walmart now, of course, and all the Home Depot centers, they're there. And Dairy Queen is accepting these things. And Carl Jr. is accepting it. I mean, they're popping up everywhere. And eventually, it will be in every single store across America because the only way that you'll be able to pay is with an RFID microchip card. And again, for the folks who really are questioning this and saying, come on, they're not going to take cash out of the system, let me just read you a quick quote that came within the last month from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia governor, Anthony Santomero, who said, "It appears our nation's pattern of payments is finally evolving." And I might put the emphasis there on finally, because again, it makes it sound from his perspective as this has really been a pain, and it's about time that this is happening. Our nation's pattern of payments is finally evolving. It's experiencing a radical change from one based on paper to one based on electronics.
Okay, Michael,
you start thinking about what's available to these guys, they're going to have every single piece of your personal private life at access to them, and they'll be able to get that data anytime they want to.
Michael, I got a question coming in. Someone wants to know, what happens if people just don't go for it? What happens if they just start their own bartering system?
Well, that's exactly what people will do. I mean, that's exactly what people will do. I know that's what I'm planning on doing. I know that, well, I'll give you a couple of things about this that are going to show that there will certainly be a barter system in place. Number one is that there's a lot of speculation, certainly within the Christian community, that this is what's leading to what they refer to in the 13:16 passage of Revelation as the mark of the coming mark of the beast. And what they're saying is that there will be a point where you will have to take a mark on the back of your hand with the number of the beast in order to continue to buy and sell things.
Okay, are you talking now about the implantable chip?
Well, that's certainly what the reference is. So again, when we talk about as this goes cashless and they say, look, we're going out of this system now, no more cash, here's your new microchip card. Well, here's the first speculation. If these things can be lost or stolen and used by anybody, can you see how that might be a setup down the future by these guys who have been lying to us all along as it is about why we have to go out of cash? And they come forward and say, boy, here's something we never thought of. Turns out these cards can be lost or stolen. Well, boy, what a brilliant conclusion we've come to here, and I don't know how we didn't see that coming. But what we'll do is we'll simply take that microchip now out of the card and put it on the back of your hand and embed it in your skin, and that way it can't be lost or stolen. And remember, I pointed out that we've got contactless ink now. So this is a microchip that could literally be an innocuous tiny tattoo on the back of your hand. So,
they've
got a point.
What if I refuse?
Again, that's why I say a lot of these people will be refusing. Certainly a majority of the Christian population will be refusing. And look at where it is stands now. Look at the general groups of Christians that are out there now. We talk about like the Mennonites and the Hatterites and the Amish and the Quakers and the Mormons. Well, these are groups that are basically working outside of this system now and have been anyways. They've been basically storing food and water, and they barter with each other and other groups. And again, it's the same thing. What happens if you refuse? I'll give you that in a nutshell. The first thing they're going to say is, oh, look, it's voluntary. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. You only have to have this microchip if you want food or medicine for your kids. Well, at that point, a lot of people start volunteering for it when it comes down to medicine for the children. However, stepping outside of that system is what a lot of people will be doing, myself included. The way to
What do you mean by that, Michael? Yourself included.
Well, myself included, meaning I'm making plans. I'm looking forward, and I'm making plans for this so that I won't be one of the people when they say, oh, look, you don't have to have this thing unless you want to be able to provide medicine for your children. I will have had plans in place to be able to provide that medicine for my children prior to this event so that I won't have
how?
To be involved. I will have stored long-term storable foods, for one thing. And the other thing that I'll have done to begin with is I will have been moving a lot of my money into gold. And that's something I've been doing for many years because, again, this you talk about, will we go to a barter system? Give me anything you can think of that will be more widely accepted in a barter system than gold. It's been here for 5,000 years. It's been the world's money. It still is the world's money today, not these paper notes we're used to seeing. No other nations are trading between themselves on these paper notes. They're still trading gold back and forth. And again, the gold value never changes. You might remember I made the comment from 1967 when my folks bought that house. Well, that was $16,000 or 472 ounces of gold. Today, the same house, $200,000 or the exact same 472 ounces of gold. So since gold isn't losing its buying power ever, I put my money into gold. The second I do that, I begin to protect my money's buying power loss. And the second thing I do is I give myself an economic safety net from this fallout so that I can step back and say, you know what, I do need medicine, but I'm not willing to put that mark on the back of my hand. I'm not willing to take this microchip card down to the Walgreens or down to the CVS pharmacy for medicine. And instead, I'll go to my Amish neighbors and say, look, here's a one-ounce gold piece. I need some beef, and I need some medicine for the kids.
Are you suggesting at this point that people start grouping to prepare for this?
Well, I think that's a pretty smart idea. First off, I think when we talk about grouping, that's a good analogy for it, is that that's what we're doing right now. you and I and your listening audience and all of the listening audiences that I've spoken to, and when I had a program that I did myself for 7 years for 2 hours a day, those are a lot of people that were grouped again together with this knowledge. And simply when I say this knowledge, I mean starting off with the aspect of how many people even knew when we began this conversation that the Federal Reserve was a private company that was tax-free for profit, both state and federal, collecting $1 trillion annually and splitting it between 300 people. Probably not.
Let's put some time frame on this, Michael. I don't know whether we're talking about something that's going to occur out of my lifetime or in my lifetime. Is this something I should be thinking about over the next few years or the next few months? Or
if we're talking about taking cash out of the system as far as actually pulling that the banks are closed holiday business, I think we're talking about that happening within the next 2 years.
The next 2 years?
Yep.
So, in other words, people need to, when I say grouping, people need to physically start getting together, right?
No question about it. You know,
we've
talked about a lot of analogies. We've hit on a lot of cliches, but here's a big one, you know. It comes down to united we stand, divided we fall.
So we need to get together to unite as a group.
And educate each other. I mean, that is the first key to this, is beginning to say, hey, you know, there's an issue going on here that they're not telling us about. And the reason they're not telling us about it is very simple. They don't want you to know. This group of private bankers that own all of this, of course, they own all of the major stakes and all of the major media outlets, and they own all the loans to these characters. So if these are not guys who are willing to let go of this information, they simply say to CBS and NBC and Fox, look, open your mouth, and I'm going to cash out my 10% stake, and I'm going to call in my loans. You guys think you'll make it through by morning? I doubt it. So again, that's you know, they've got all the control. They've got all the power. They've got all the wealth. They've got all the property. They've got all our labor. It's a done deal. So again, I'll tell you what the first thing is to do is to educate them. If folks would like more information on who actually owns the Federal Reserve System or how they can protect their finances from the coming cashless society using gold and silver, they can call us toll-free and I'll send out information that they begin to educate themselves with and pass around. The number is toll-free. It's 1-800-685-4042. Again, it's 800-685-4042. 4042. They can call any day of the week, 24 hours a day. If they don't get a live body, leave a message with a name and phone number and address. We'll either send the packet or to call you right back, and we'll get one right out to you. And again, it's about education, and it's about sticking together, just like you pointed out.
Well, I have a question that, it's your question. Folks, often guests provide the host with some background information, background areas to cover. And one of the ones that really caught my eye was how far away can these implanted microchips be scanned? Is this something you have to stand up against, or can they scan me a block away?
Good question. When we talk about this, the first thing we both, you and I, should know being involved in radio, because this is the key to this, is this. It's a radio frequency ID chip. So if I've got a radio station and it doesn't provide a signal that gets out more than, let's say, 10 miles away, but I need to hit 30 miles away, what's the next thing I can do? As soon as I get to that 10th mile, I can hook up a repeater, and I can power that signal back up and send it back out again further. So the same thing can be done when we talk about these readers. Right now, they're using the scanners to read RFID microchips in salmon that are migrating. And as they go by the bank, they're reading these things from about 25 feet away. But again, not a problem to read somebody and pick off all of their financial information, all of their medical history, which could be stored on a microchip, from a football field away or farther.
Absolutely astounding. Michael, we are out of time. Can we get you back at some point?
Anytime you'd like. All you got to do is get in touch with Stephanie, and she'll hook up a date anytime.
Absolutely fascinating. There's a lot of topics that we just haven't been able to get into, a lot more detail. I certainly would like it. Also, I'd like some more suggestions on the grouping of people and how they can do that. Michael, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and please be safe on your journeys.
Thank you, and I appreciate it. You as well. My pleasure to be with you tonight.
Good night.
Take care.
Well, folks, I would usually end the show at this time, but since we are in the midst of creating a new format, what's going to happen is I'm going to take a 10-minute break, and then I'm going to come back and start a third hour. Now, this third hour is going to be a sort of an icebreaker. I just want to test it out, and I'm going to have a little bit of fun with it.
So if Don is listening, he will get us off the air, and I'll be doing a break. I'm back, folks. Now, this is going to be a little bit different, and I'm sure we're not going to be on for very long. First, the thing that I want to do, if there's a listening audience out there, is to give you the call-in number again. It is 1-888-268-4313. Now, there's no one else in the studio. There are no guests online. So, Don, as you're listening, go ahead and make sure that that call-in line is open. If anybody wants to call in at this point, please do so. What's going to happen to this show over time, and where's it going to go? The plan is to maintain the first hour for a guest. There will be one guest during that first hour, and we will have the normal interview format. The second hour, if this goes according to plan, is going to be a sort of a variety hour, where we will have two, maybe possibly three authors at a time come on the show and talk about their most latest book. And I'm not talking about authors that have 1,000 books out there. I'm looking for new authors. So, if anyone is out there that has written a book and is trying to get it published, please give us a call, get in touch with me on my email, which is nevin@bloginservice.com. I'm sure most of the listening audience already knows how to get in touch. But if you've written a book or you're trying to get a book published, get in touch and we will get you on the air to discuss it. So what am I doing here tonight? Well, the third hour is going to be open lines. And my intention is to have open lines for anything, including personal problems. If you go to my website, you'll be able to find a background and a resume on me. I do have a PhD in psychology. I spent 25 years in clinical practice. So if anybody wants to get on the line and discuss personal problems without revealing your identity, I have absolutely no problem with that at all. We can discuss a variety of topics. Just call in, folks. Just go ahead and do it. Pick up that phone and dial 1-888-268-4313. Well, like I said before, I'm no Indiana Jones, and I'm much too old to go traveling around the planet searching in deep, dark caves. But I can search out some of those mysteries that might be lying around in cyberspace. For this, all you need is a PC and an internet provider, and of course, Google. With Google, you can find out just about anything. You have a thought in your head, just type it into Google search engine, and you'll come up with 1,000 websites with that same thought. So, tonight, I'm going to give you some mini forbidden knowledge. Aha! What is it? Well, have you ever wondered about the ingredients in a hot dog? Remember I mentioned at the first hour the introduction of the hot dog and where it came from. In all honesty, there's a lot of confusion about where hot dogs come from. Basically, everybody will agree it comes out of Germany, and
What is a hot dog? Well, think about it, folks. It's a sausage. I mean, that's exactly what it is. It's just a sausage with a different type of approach. Typically, sausage is pork butt. Pork butt that's ground up either in fine or coarse, and some ingredients are put in. Now, everybody has asked about what are the ingredients in a hot dog. Well, I went on the net and I searched. Well, contrary to some of the wild rumors about what are in hot dogs, there really are some strict government standards regulating what a hot dog can contain. First of all, most of them in the variety of pack, they are basically a mixture of meats, pork, beef, chicken, turkey, and it is a combination. But one thing I will say is that the meat is always from the muscle of the animal, muscle tissue. So, are you eating organ meat in a turkey, in a hot dog? Absolutely not. It is under strict government control. And they have a certain kind of additives, curing agents, spices such as garlic, salt, sugar, mustard, white pepper. And this is all put into a huge blender. This blender beats the muscle tissue and these ingredients into kind of almost a pancake batter. And that batter is then shoved into the hot dog skin. The skin can be an artificial type skin, and sometimes it's the actual intestine of an animal. Most of the hot dogs, I come to find out, no longer use the intestine. It is all artificial. Well, these stainless steel choppers mix the meat, they put all the ingredients in, and they jam it into a funnel, which goes into the casing. Once the casings are filled, then they are linked into long strands and then cooked under extremely rigid conditions. Again, it's all government control. So, what was the longest hot dog? Aha, 1,996 feet. And guess who made it? It was the Sara Lee Corporation, and it was in honor of the 1996 Olympics. That's why it was 1,996 feet long. The favorite topping? Well, if you're over 35, you're going to put mustard. If you're under 35, you're probably going to use ketchup. And there's a hot dog month. July. I guess that's when everybody is out in the backyards barbecuing, so it kind of makes sense. The top three hot dog eating cities. New York, L.A., Baltimore. Why Baltimore? I have no idea. The champion of the National Hot Dog Eating Contest held each year at Coney Island receives a yellow belt. I guess kind of like somebody training in karate. You get a yellow belt depending on, I guess, how much you can consume. Last year, the winner ate 50 hot dogs, including the bun. And when they do the contest, they have to do it in a timed fashion. This person ate 50 hot dogs with buns in 12 minutes. How many hot dogs are sold? 1.8 billion hot dogs were sold in the U.S. markets last year. And at Major League ballparks, over 24.2 million hot dogs were sold. Well, the history of the hot dog and where it comes from, I'm going to use a funny word here, frankly, probably goes to Frankfurt, Germany. That's probably where it originated. There is some confusion as to why it is called a hot dog. Now, there is a story about a cartoonist, Ted Dorgan. People believe he gave the hot dog its name when he created a cartoon of New York vendors selling Dachshund sausages and yelling, "Get your Dachshund sausage while they're red hot." Well, Dorgan was unsure how to spell Dachshund, which is D-A-C-H-S-H-U-N-D-S, and he simply changed it to hot dog. However, the true origin remains an unsolved mystery today. Folks, that's it for tonight. Thank you for listening, and please have a safe journey.
That ends our show for tonight. Again, it was a fascinating journey into the realms of forbidden knowledge. Until next time, this is Nevin Campanella, wishing all of you health, happiness, and a safe journey on your chosen path. Good night.